He takes her out to this nice dinner. Then they go see a movie. They get home and Tony surprises her with champagne. And he gets down on one knee. And he tells her he's been having an affair for months and he's leaving.
Oh my God.
And then he did.
What?
Why?
I know. How? Like, yeah, he's just being a dick at this point.
He is a dick.
It's Tuesday, and you're listening to Murder Unscripted.
My name's Ed, and for the past 2 decades, I've been producing true crime content for some of your favorite networks like Hulu, Oxygen, and of course, Investigation Discovery.
And I'm Melissa, Ed's bestie and walking, talking true crime database.
We've combined my behind-the-scenes insight with Melissa's morbid curiosity to bring you a podcast that immerses you in the true crime genre like never before.
We highlight victims' cases and bring you exclusive insight from the people who lived through them, with a touch of humor to lighten even the darkest stories.
This is Murder Unscripted.
Dun dun dun.
What is up, crime crew? Welcome to Murder Unscripted, episode number 8080, the internet's most immersive true crime podcast. I'm Ed Hydock, along with the gift that keeps on giving, Melissa Spivey.
I can't tell if that's like flattering or you're saying like I'm herpes. Like, it keeps going,
like... Every time I turn around, there you are. So yeah, kind of like
exactly.
Well, Melissa, it is the first week of December, and you know, as well as everyone knows, what that means.
New month, new block, new theme.
Yep.
Yay!
That is it. And just like we did last year, we're going to use December as sort of a 2025 grab bag. Like for all the themes that we've covered throughout the year, we pick our favorites and kind of bring you another case from that block. Gives us a chance to highlight some stories we couldn't fit in or topics that we just wanted to dig into a little bit more.
Yeah, I love this because I'm terrible about deciding on a case and change my mind half a dozen times before I settle on one.
Right. It's so hard.
It is. Well, today I'm going to go back all the way to the beginning. The first theme of 2025 was serial killers.
Yes,
and
it was.
We covered two of the most well-known serial killers, Theodore Ted Bundy and John Wayne Gacy.
Yeah, and the reason we did that is because we had two incredible guests that month. We had Edna Cal Martin, Ted Bundy's cousin who had grown up with him, and then Dr. Jeffrey Smalden, who spent a lot of time trying to get in Gacy's big fat head prior to his execution.
They were definitely two of my favorite guests.
Definitely.
So in a recap to our serial killers block, I'm covering a serial killer. No surprise.
Good thinking.
And this is going to be a two-parter. It ended up being way longer than I meant it to be. So it's going to be a two-parter. And the guy I'm covering, he's definitely not as well known as Bundy, Gacy, Dahmer, but he's just as heinous. And this is kind of a similar situation to my case a few weeks ago with Daniel Corwin, the forgotten serial killer.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested to see how many people have heard about this guy who would come to be known as the Tourniquet Killer.
Ooh.
And that is Anthony Allen Shore. And he started killing in 1986, and he would not be caught until 2003, which is pretty scary.
The 80s were like prime time for serial killers. And not to derail us before we even start, but I feel like we're going to see less and less serial killers in our lifetime because of technology and how far things have advanced, because it is so much harder to just operate and move around undetected these days. And I don't know. I think it's a dying art, the serial killer. So anyway, sorry, proceed.
I mean, fingers crossed. Well, quick warning, my guy today is a really, really, really bad dude, and his crimes are extremely evil and deplorable. So we are going to have to unfortunately discuss the rape and murder of young women and girls, and a very quick mention of animal abuse. I won't go into extreme detail, but we still need to talk about these victims. They deserve their stories to be told.
Absolutely, they do.
So with that, let's discuss the crimes of Anthony Allen Shore, who, just like Daniel Corwin, committed his crimes in Houston, Texas.
I had no idea Houston was such a hotbed for this kind of stuff.
I know. I feel like I keep picking Houston murder cases.
It's weird. Probably thought we should do a Houston block.
Maybe we should.
No.
Well, I want to mention that I watched several television programs about this guy. There are a ton. There's like 7 or 8 different shows about him. I watched I Lived with a Killer, Mark of a Serial Killer, and an OG Cold Case Files episode.
Ooh, that wasn't on those. I was on the new one.
Yeah, it was like, I think it was early 2000s.
Gotcha.
And another source I used big time was a book called Strangler, which was written by Corey Mitchell. Corey Mitchell is pretty big in like the true crime book world because in addition to The Strangler, he's written a few other books, including one about the yogurt shop murders.
Oh, you're kidding. Well, I guess Texas, yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah, true.
He might be from Texas. I have to look it up.
Yeah, I didn't look him up too deeply, but he's pretty, the book was really good.
Good.
Well, I am going to switch things up today, and we are actually going to start kind of at the end. Not the end of the case with the conviction, but like the end of the crimes and the beginning of the end for Anthony Alan Shore. Well, it's Friday, October 24th, 2003 at 4:53 p.m., and we are in Houston PD's Homicide Division, Interrogation Room Number 6. I need to introduce Detective Todd Miller. He's been with the force for 22 years, and the last 12 of them have been in the Homicide Division. And he's actually a member of a special task force that was put together to catch the man who would become known as the Tourniquet Killer. So, Detective Miller and his cohorts, they've arrested 41-year-old Anthony Alan Shore, and he went by Tony, so I may refer to him as Tony or Shore. It's 5 p.m., and Shore's just sitting in the interrogation room when Detective Miller walks in. He reads him his rights, which Tony waives, and then Miller offers him something to eat or drink, both of which are declined. And then Miller goes on to tell Tony that he's been arrested for the murder of Maria Carmen Del Estrada, who usually went by Carmen, and his DNA, which was in the system due to a sex crime that we will get to later, but his DNA was a match to the DNA found on Carmen. While Detective Miller's talking to him, Tony doesn't show like any sort of emotion, so Detective Miller continues on, and the two men begin kind of chatting. And Tony denies that he killed Carmen. He claims he's never even seen her before. Like,
it's got his DNA.
Yeah, I know. And during all of this, he's super calm, maybe a little bit cocky, but definitely unbothered by these horrible accusations against him. And it seems like Miller's using that interrogation tactic and trying to play like good cop and acting like Tony's friend.
I love good cop, bad cop. It's a proven technique, actually, that plays on the human psychology. Like bad cop starts with the threats and all the accusations, and then good cop comes in sympathetic and helpful so that I feel like, one, the suspect feels safe to open up, possibly revealing more information. And two, it instinctively makes bad cop's threats even more like severe.
No, that's true. And remember, in Artis Woods' case, the guy went in too hard at the beginning and then had to pivot and try to be the guy's friend. Well, Miller would later say that he and Tony had a, quote, congenial conversation. However, one thing that kind of surprised and stunned him is that within only a few minutes of chatting, he went from Tony calling him Detective Miller to just straight up calling him Todd.
Oh, man, that's a power move.
It is.
Yeah.
And in the book I mentioned, Miller is like, I have never, ever had a suspect call me by my first name.
Wow.
So the men continue chatting for 3 full hours. It's 8:05 p.m. now, and it's clear that Miller is getting nowhere fast. So Miller asks Shore again if he wants food, drink, offers him a bathroom break, all of which Tony declines again. So Miller goes to the other members of the task force to ask them, like, what do we want to do next? And this task force is made up of 4 men. I believe it was 2 from Houston PD and 2 from Harris County Sheriff Department.
Okay.
Over the years, there were like several task forces put together to solve this case. So it's a little confusing, like who is from what agency.
That happens, especially in these cases that drag on for a lot of time. I mean, people move on, task force disband, you know.
Yeah. And the span of this guy's crimes is almost 20 years. Right. So. The next member to go try and kind of crack Tony was Sergeant John Swaim. And again, Tony calls the detective by his first name within just a few minutes of talking to him. And pretty much right away, Swaim knows that he's dealing with an incredibly intelligent man, which always sucks when the serial killers are like super smart.
But they are. They have to be to avoid getting caught.
Yeah. Well, Swaim would tell author Corey Mitchell that Tony, quote, did not show any of the normal signs, through my experience, of someone who was lying, end quote.
Interesting. So either he's innocent or he's a true sociopath like Bundy, like a master manipulator. Like those are the scariest kinds of killers because they're the least suspecting. They're hiding in plain sight. Perverts don't wear signs.
Exactly. And this is definitely that one.
Wow.
So over the next few hours, Swaim would talk with Tony, and eventually another member of the task force would attempt to crack Tony. But when that didn't work, Miller was sent back in. But this time, he brought crime scene pictures. So Miller put the photos on the table in front of Tony, and Tony like looked away for a split second, but then looked back at the pictures. And Miller reiterated to Tony that they had his DNA, they knew he was the one who had killed these girls. And this is when they kind of start making progress, like when things start to change. Tony suddenly stops denying the accusations, and it goes from, I've never seen her, I don't know what you're talking about, to, I don't remember. Which, like, there's that selective amnesia that we talk about so much, and he definitely seems to have that.
It's right up there with I blacked out during the attack. That's everyone's favorite.
Well, wait till you hear his excuse.
I can't wait.
Oh, yeah. And, like, because here's what he'll do. He'll give details of the assaults and murders, but then he'll say something like, I can't remember because my brain wasn't right. It's the sickness.
No, the sickness. I really wish we had the power to know exactly what goes on inside the criminal mind, because how many times have we heard killers say this? Like, is it really something uncontrollable that snaps inside them? Or is it like a convenient excuse that they all just have pre-programmed to cover up what they did? Like, either they're embarrassed or I don't know what, but they all seem to say it.
I think in this case, he's definitely using it to try to get out of this, or maybe set up an insanity plea later.
Gotcha.
But it's like, anytime he's out there raping or killing or attacking, it's not him. It's the sickness that took over. Yes,
the monster, the demon.
Yes. So it is getting later and later. And after about 90 minutes, Tony finally begins to ask Miller, quote, let's say, hypothetically, someone were to... And he suddenly stops and tells Detective Miller, who he calls Todd.
But he goes, Todd.
Todd, I'm sorry. I just can't trust you.
He was so close. Like, Todd's got to
be. I'm sure he felt like a deflated balloon. Like, I could have been like, oh, man.
Yeah, you're like on the edge of your seat going, finish your sentence.
Yes. Well, he remains professional. And he asked Tony, he's like, okay, well, is there someone else you would trust that you want to talk to? And surprisingly, Tony tells him to send in John Swaim. So when John enters the room, it's 11:50 p.m. We got here at 4:53 p.m. So it's been hours. And I think that John is over it at this point, because he basically comes in and he's like, all right, what do you have to say? Like,
he's done with him. Yeah.
He's just over it. So Tony grabs the binder of crime scene pictures. He pushes them towards Swaim, looks him square in the eyes, and says, quote, what would you say if I gave you these cases and a couple of bonuses?
No way. A couple of bonuses. Man, that's huge.
Who says that, though?
Well, it just means that these cops are on the brink of uncovering something huge, huge.
Yes. Well, Swaim is being, you know, he's being cool, and he's like, well, that would be great. And also, what is all this hypothetical stuff you were talking about?
Yeah, because he could be talking out his ass, too.
Of course.
Yeah.
Well, Tony begins with, quote, well, I have this evilness in me. And then he goes on to say, I think if I tell you what I've done, it will release the evilness and I will feel better. End quote.
Interesting.
So Tony's like, okay. And this is when Tony stops for a few minutes. There's quiet. And then he asks John, what am I being charged with? And Swaim responds that it's ultimately up to the prosecutor's office, but he's like, if you tell me what I think you're going to tell me, that would be capital murder, which carries one of two things, either life in prison or the death penalty.
He's up front.
Yeah. And the whole time, Tony's expression does not change. Like, he doesn't even bat an eye when he says, like, the death penalty.
Right, because he's probably had tons of time to think about all this and clearly has come to peace with whatever he's about to say, as evidenced by the fact that he's starting to hint at the crimes, like dropping these little breadcrumbs. Now, it's the question is, are these breadcrumbs legit, or is he just saying stuff to get out of other trouble?
Well, John knows it's legit pretty quickly, because after probably what seemed like an eternity of silence, Tony leans in right at John, looks him in the eyes, and says, does the name Laurie Tremblay mean anything to you, John?
Wow.
And this is when the detective just about fell out of his chair. That name meant so much to him. Swinton had worked years on trying to solve Laurie's murder. Her case was the one that haunted him.
Damn, there had to be literal chills going up the back of Swaim's neck, especially if he'd been chasing this guy and, like, Tony wasn't even on the radar.
And he wasn't. Like, so Swaim was just, you know, and that's got to be crazy because this case he worked on for, like, 17 years, he can't let it go. And then this random guy
comes out of the woodwork.
Totally different. Yeah, comes in and says that.
Wow.
Well, before we get to Laurie, Carmen, and the other young women and girls that were murdered by this monster, we need to start with his life and see what kind of went wrong, or if we want to go the nature versus nurture route. So we need to go back to June 25th, 1962. That's the day this evil chunk of sewage, Anthony Allen Shore, was born to Robert and Deanna Shore on Ellsworth Air Force Base in Rapid City, South Dakota. And I read some reports that both of his parents were in the military and some that just said his dad was.
Mm-hmm.
All right, before I go any further, keep in mind that a lot of what we know about Anthony's early childhood is from his perspective, and he's a liar. Like, a huge liar. So take everything with a grain of salt.
Most serial killers are.
Mm-hmm. So Anthony's born in June of 1962. 2 years later, his sister Regina joins the family. And then 4 years after that, younger sister Laurel joins the family. Now, due to Robert's job, he was apparently really good at computers, and there weren't a ton of people who were good at that. So he was in really high demand. So due to that, the family moved around a ton. Like, they lived in South Dakota, New York City, Kansas, Georgia, California, literally coast to coast all over the country.
Yeah, see, then we know how difficult that can be for children. Like, it makes it hard to make new friends. It also has to make it hard at school because some schools might be ahead of others.
Well, if you ask Tony, he claims his early life was unstable, chaotic. He says he was abused and that his parents were constantly fighting and constantly yelling and always cheating on one another.
Oh, so he saw it even as a kid. That's interesting.
Well, this is what he's saying.
Oh, right.
And he also claims that his mother molested him, which everybody in the family denies. And I don't think that claim is true because something we'll get to later.
Okay.
Well, his parents decide to divorce at some point, but, like, his sisters say that they had a very normal upbringing. And I do want to say, I was reading through Reddit about this case, and someone commented that since the family was always moving around for the dad's job, this led to Tony leaning into a belief where the patriarch was king.
Like, one of these.
Made the decisions, and the family followed these decisions. And I don't know if it's that deep, but we will see later as an adult, Tony definitely believes he is king of the castle when it comes to his wife and children.
Well, I mean, you can see signs of it already, that he's all about power. Like, even him calling detectives by their first name, like, he likes to be in charge.
Well, what's really a shame about this case is the wasted potential that Anthony had within him. The author of the book Strangler refers to Tony as, quote, a musical prodigy who never realized his potential, end quote. So Tony became interested in music at the age of 3. And in a couple years, his father bought him a secondhand guitar. Tony learned to play the guitar and he played exceptionally well, but he completely taught himself. And, like, that's kind of how it was with any musical instrument he picked up. He just had this gift and he could listen to a song from any music genre. And within a few minutes, he could play it on whatever instrument you handed him.
That's pretty cool.
That's pretty incredible.
Yeah.
And remember, at the beginning, the detective said, I knew this was a very intelligent man.
Yeah. Again, a lot of them are.
Yeah. Well, despite his musical abilities, I think it was pretty clear early on that Tony was a monster in the making. Trigger warning for animal abuse. Skip ahead 30 seconds. Once when he was a child, he was about 5 years old, and his neighbor got a kitten, and Tony wanted the kitten as his own. And his mom was like, no, it's not yours. Like, you need to take the cat back to the neighbor. But instead, he stabbed the kitten to death.
Oh my God. Like, isn't that, that's not a sign of things to come.
Right.
I know animal abuse is like one of those big red flags, mm-hmm. you know, but I guarantee he had the same, if I can't have you, no one can mentality when it came to his victims.
You're absolutely right. That's such a good point. Because. That's kind of how it is. He wants to be in control.
Yeah.
Well, according to the book, his mother was obviously concerned. Like, she knew about the kitten and she was super concerned. And she reached out to the family's pastor for help. There wasn't any more detail, but clearly it didn't work. It
didn't work, yeah.
Yeah. Well, around the time that Tony was in sixth grade, his family was living in Florida. And they actually stayed in this location for about 3 years, which was like an eternity compared to the other places they lived. So his sister, Regina, she talks about how she and Tony would ride bikes around the neighborhood, which sounds so wholesome. Yeah. But of course it wasn't, because Tony would manipulate his sister into going to a friend's house and asking the friend to hang out. And then while the friend was with Tony, he'd be trying to rope her and touch her, and he was just being wildly inappropriate. And these were like fourth grade girls.
Right. Well, how messed up is it too that he's using the sister to basically capture victims?
So we learn also very early, he's so manipulative. He wants control and he's a master manipulator.
Even so young. Wow.
Yeah. That's so scary.
Yeah.
Well, Regina finally stood up to her brother one day because he wanted Regina to ask her teacher's daughter to come out and play. And Regina knew what he was going to do. And yeah. She was like, this is going to come back on me with my teacher. And as if all that wasn't bad enough, decades later, his sisters, Laurel and Regina, would admit that Tony had molested them.
So he's clearly a sicko.
Yeah. And the worst about all of this, though, is that he's a very charismatic sick monster. Very Bundy, very Gacy. People were drawn to these men because of their outgoing personalities.
Is he good looking?
Maybe back then he was considered good looking. I think he looks slimy.
Okay. Well, you know the outcome, though. Like, you're looking at this guy.
I would not think he was attractive. No.
Okay. You have weird taste, though. So
that's so true. Because in the book, he talks like he's like such like a player, of course, but we know he's a liar.
Well, Gacy had that charisma, too, and he was a meatball. So
he was a meatball. Well, at some point when Tony was a teenager, his parents did divorce, and he spent the next few years kind of bouncing between them.
If that's true, I can see how that would add to the stuff that's already going on in his head, because he was already dealing with the moving around so much. Mm-hmm. And then when you put a divorce on top of that, we know how divorce can affect even just normal children. The question is, how much did that play into the monster he became?
Right. And there's more about this section of his life, but honestly, he's such a liar that it's hard to know what's true. Like,
yeah.
He claims he was in a band that opened for the rock band Heart.
Yeah, and I was in NSYNC.
Oh, you wish. I wish. Well, in 1983, Tony was 21 years old, and he moved to Houston, Texas. And he began working for Southwestern Bell as a telephone technician. And this is also around the time when he met his first wife, Gina Worley. So it's a little confusing. His sister's Regina.
Yeah, and Regina and Gina. Gina.
Yeah.
Got it.
So wife Gina was also born into a military family. Her parents were divorced, so we have a similar upbringing to Tony. This is so gross. But when they met, which was right after Thanksgiving of 83, it turned out that they lived in the same apartment building. And one day, Gina's getting her mail when a, as she puts it, handsome and charismatic man came up to her and said, "Hi, I'm Tony. I'm the nicest guy you'll ever meet."
Barf, what a tool.
Such a tool. Mm. Well, Gina saw this as charming. I would see it as stranger danger. I would blow my safety whistle and I would run away.
Same.
But you do you, Gina.
Wow.
Well, Tony and Gina were pretty hot and heavy almost immediately. Gina had been kind of a quiet bookworm, like wallflower type of girl when she was younger. So I would be willing to bet that that played into the attraction to Tony, because she was just so infatuated with him. You know, he's in a band, he's very outgoing, he's the life of the party.
Mm-hmm.
And he could probably have any woman, but he's interested in the most shy and quiet woman in the room.
So you wonder if that's so he can easily manipulate them. Maybe that overwhelming feeling of love they feel when they're with this new, like, bad boy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
On March 25th, 1984, only 4 months after they met, Tony and Gina were married in what she would later call a small and intimate ceremony at the Justice of the Peace. And only 1 month after that, she was pregnant with their first child, a daughter they named Amber. And this is when things start going downhill. They didn't really fight, but there was definitely a lot of tension in their marriage. Money was very tight, which that's always stressful in a marriage. But then you add in a crying newborn, and that's a recipe for disaster.
Sure is.
And to make matters worse, after Gina gave birth to Amber, Tony started telling Gina she was fat, which like really and understandably hurt her feelings.
What an awful thing to say to somebody. And like, I saw a picture of her and she was tiny.
She was like barely 110 pounds soaking wet. She was teeny, teeny tiny. Well, Amber was born in April of 1985. And then in June of 86, their second daughter, Tiffany, was born. So now we have two kids, the family's still struggling financially. So Gina is working. Sometimes she was working two jobs. She's raising two children and she's keeping the household running because Tony was useless when it came to doing anything like taking care of the kids or doing anything around the house. So Gina is obviously busy. And this is when Tony starts resenting everything that is taking up Gina's time.
Well, yeah, you've already exposed his like man is king beliefs. I mean, he wanted all this attention to himself.
Yeah. And he was getting so jealous, like of his own children, which is so warped.
You hear that in these relationships sometimes. Do. Why do men have such egos?
Yeah.
I don't understand.
I don't either. Well, shortly after Tiffany was born and she was the second child, Anthony wanted to have sex with Gina. And at this point, this was very shortly after she gave birth to Tiffany. She's still healing. She's not even medically cleared to have sex. And especially because this tiny 110-pound woman gave birth vaginally to a 9-pound baby.
Ooh.
So she told Tony, no, absolutely not.
Wow.
Tony did not take this very well, and he raped her.
I'm not surprised in the least.
Yeah. Well, Gina said in the book, she's like, things were never the same after that, which obviously...
I think?
Yeah. And as if all that wasn't bad enough, as Amber got a little older, Tony and Gina began noting some atypical development patterns. And after evaluating her behaviors and characteristics, Amber was diagnosed with PDD, which was pervasive development disorder. And I think we actually talked about that a few weeks ago with our case.
Yeah, that's the only reason I know about it.
Well, and we also talked about how that term is most definitely outdated. Like the Strangler book's a little bit older.
Yeah, it's autism, right?
Yes. In 2025, it now falls under the umbrella of autism spectrum disorder.
Okay.
Gina said Amber didn't really speak until she was about 6 or 7. I think she would speak a little bit, but not like a ton until she was a little older. So obviously I can't speak from experience, but I have no doubt that this is a very hard situation that they are handling, that they're trying to navigate. But Tony's attitude is foul. Like he responds to this by shunning Amber. He wanted nothing to do with her. He would call her names, including the R word. He was constantly talking about how dumb she was.
Wow.
Yeah. And he would say it so that way she couldn't hear. But Gina's like, she knows how you feel about her. Like, kids aren't stupid. She knows. Like, and he was like, she doesn't know. She's too stupid.
That's so messed up. Mm-hmm. So messed up. Yeah, kids can obviously tell just by how you act on the day-to-day.
Absolutely. And Tony was just cruel to Amber because he wanted things to always be perfect. And in his eyes, Amber was not perfect. And therefore, he didn't want anything to do with her.
Yeah. And she's one more thing, taking time away from his wife.
Exactly. And Amber definitely acted out, but I don't think she could help it. And Tony made it well known that Tiffany was his favorite. She was his precious daddy's girl. Well, Amber was just something that had to be tolerated.
That poor girl. That's heartbreaking.
Yeah, it really is. And like, even without the rapes and murders I'm going to tell you about, Tony was just a monster. And his treatment of his kids would get significantly worse. But we're going to take a break from Tony for a minute. And I want to talk about the day he kills his first victim. And this is the case that had haunted Sergeant John Swaim for 17 years. So it's Friday, September 26, 1986, and it's about 7:15 in the morning when Homer Fernandez pulls up to the restaurant he manages, and it's called Ninfa's Restaurant. Well, fun fact, a woman named Ninfa Rodriguez Lorenzo, aka Mama Ninfa, she opened this restaurant, which eventually opened several locations, And she is actually credited with popularizing Tex-Mex as like an everyday term. Yeah. And she's credited with starting the fajita craze.
Oh my God. Bless her.
Hold on. Just so nobody flips out in the comments, I'm not saying she invented any fajitas or Tex-Mex. I'm saying she popularized it.
That'd be a bold statement.
I know. I get so much hate.
Well, whatever she did, tip of the sombrero to Miss Ninfa, because as I've said many times on this program, if I were on death row and I had a final meal, it would be fajitas, hands down.
Mm, that would be a good choice.
Bottomless. Ooh, I would just eat fajitas.
We have a last meal in this case.
Oh.
So we'll get there.
The irony is if it were fajitas.
It would. That would be pretty great. It's not, though. So anyway, Homer pulls up to the back of the restaurant and he parks at the back entrance, which is what he always did when he opened because the alarm's in the like at the back door. So before he goes into the building, he turns the car off and then he starts going through some paperwork. Suddenly he looks up and he sees a light blue car sitting near the dumpsters. And this is weird because A, it's early in the morning and like none of the stores are open yet. And B, it's the back of the shopping center. Like, why would anyone else be back there?
I would think somebody's just dumping trash.
Yeah, I guess.
You know what I mean? Whenever I see cars doing that, like, it's just they're illegally dumping trash. That's kind of what I assume.
Yeah, that's fair. Well, he was kind of just like, that's weird, because he opened all the time and he'd never seen anyone else back there.
Yeah.
But Homer shrugs it off. He goes back to his paperwork. Just a minute or two later, he looks up to see a man who got out of the car. He's standing near the dumpster. And there's a person laying on the ground at his feet.
Oh, wow.
And Homer's like, oh, my God. And he quick looks back down at his paperwork because he's not trying to draw attention to himself.
Right.
Well, the driver of the little blue car runs back to his vehicle and speeds out of the parking lot.
Man, I have mixed feelings about this. Like, he put his head back down. But at the same time, if you saw that, wouldn't you speak up? Be like, yo.
I don't know. I feel like it all happened really fast.
Like, if I saw a body on the ground, I would instantly speak up.
I would like to think I would, but I don't know, because what if the person has a gun or something?
True.
So when Homer knows this guy is gone, he kind of gets out of the car and he gathers the courage to check on what he can now see is the body of a teenage girl. And Homer can tell this girl's dead pretty much immediately, and the book describes her body as, quote, a human pretzel.
Oh my God. That's a new and disturbing way to describe a victim. Like, I've never, in all my years, have never heard that description. That's awful.
Yeah, I had to reread that part several times because I was just like, that is a wild way to describe anything.
Yeah.
Well, the girl's young. She's got blonde hair and she's mostly clothed. She had on capri pants and then her shirt was pushed up, sort of covering her neck and like exposing her bra. And we later find out, and she's like kind of on her back, so we later find out that the bra had been unclasped in the back.
Okay.
So her lips are swollen and off color. She's got what looks to be like a black eye is starting to form. There's some scratches on her face. And she has a red line going around her neck.
Strangled with a rope or something.
Well, Homer runs inside and calls the police. Police arrive at the scene, and shortly thereafter is Detective John Swaim. Like, that's when he gets here. Okay. So he's on this case from like day one. He and his fellow officers all agree that the victim had been strangled, even though there was no ligature to be seen. And FYI, a ligature is like a rope or a cord, something to bind something else with.
Mm-hmm.
So the detective also notices that the victim still has jewelry on. She's got several rings. She's got a few necklaces and her purse is with her body. So it's pretty evident this wasn't like a robbery gone wrong. So as officers inspect her purse, they come across her bus card, which IDs her as 15-year-old Laurie Tremblay.
I keep forgetting that she was 15. That makes this even more disturbing.
15, I know.
Awful.
So Laurie Lee Tremblay was born on September 17th, 1971, to a young woman who had actually just turned 20. So her mom was really young and kind of not ready for that. And Laurie's father was never really in the picture. So when her mom decides that she's unable to care for her, Laurie goes to Michigan and she's raised by her grandparents until the age of 10. And she loved it. She did really well. Well, when she turned 10, that was when her mom had gotten back on her feet and she wanted Laurie to come live with her in Houston. She's like, let's be a family. Well, when Laurie got to Texas, things went pretty well for a few years. She made friends. She did well in school. But once she turned 13, that kind of started to change. Suddenly, she seemed really depressed and like she just stopped caring about really anything. And then, you know, on top of that, she started doing poorly in school. She started hanging out with a bad crowd. And eventually she got in trouble and she was kicked out of her public high school and she was sent to an alternative school.
Okay.
So this place is called the Hope Center for Youth. And while her mom was really upset and concerned for Laurie, like to go to the school, she actually did really well. She made friends. She was doing well academically. And it kind of seems like things were heading towards getting Laurie back on the right track.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
Yeah. The only negative thing about the school was the transportation of Laurie getting from the apartment she shared with her mom to the school.
They didn't have a bus that picked her up?
So because it's like an alternative school, I don't believe they had buses.
Okay.
So I guess the public school should have still been responsible for getting somebody her to the health center.
Right.
And her bus stop was like 2 miles away. So Laurie ends up taking, her mom wants her to take the Houston Metro public transportation. And her mom's not pumped about that, but she'd rather that than her walking all this way.
Yeah, I'm not sure how I'd feel about my 15-year-old taking public transport. I mean, they're all clearly old enough, but they're still dangerous.
Oh, yeah. Well, this whole bus debacle becomes a big deal later because after everything happens, her mom wanted to sue the schools for not figuring out a better transportation option.
She probably had grounds to do that, too.
It ended up getting thrown out ultimately. But even with taking the public bus, though, Laurie still had a bit of a hike to the bus stop. And she had to leave really early, like before when it was still dark out. So just a few hours before Laurie's body would be found, she had left her apartment and started her trek to the bus stop. What Laurie's mother didn't know was that Laurie had not been taking the bus. She'd been getting a ride from 24-year-old Anthony Allen Shore.
Damn, that's our guy.
Yeah. And the next information is coming right from his confession. A lot of it is in the book if you're interested. And again, remember, this is his narrative because we don't have Laurie's side of things.
So who knows how much is true?
Exactly. So he tells the detective that while he's driving to work in the morning, he's still working for Southwestern Bell, and he begins seeing who we know to be Laurie walking every morning.
So studying her routine, in other words.
So one day, he claims that she just asked him for a cigarette, and he doesn't really explain this, so I'm not sure if like he stopped at a red light and she randomly asked him for one from the sidewalk. I feel like he pulled up to her.
Oh, I guarantee that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know, but he agreed, he gave her a cigarette, and then he asked her if she wanted a ride. And she accepted the ride, and he took her to school that day, no problem. And this went on for a couple of weeks, and he says that they would drive around, occasionally they would get, like, breakfast pastries, and then he would take her to school. At one point, though, in his confession, he says, "She and I became involved." And he talked about how they were, like, more than friends, which is disgusting.
You are a grown man with two daughters and a wife. Like, I will never understand. It floors me when these people have daughters.
Yes.
How on earth can you do that to a young girl having daughters? I do not understand.
I don't get that either. Well, then Tony goes on to say that there were a few weeks where suddenly Laurie didn't want to ride from him. And from reading his confession in the Corey Mitchell book, it seems to me that Tony began acting inappropriately with Laurie, and she possibly realized that, okay, this guy's getting creepy, like maybe he wants a physical relationship with me, and she tries to avoid him. Well, one day it was raining, and he saw her, and he's like, "Hey, do you want a ride?" Which she accepted. Now, he, of course, doesn't say explicitly what he did, but he does say that he tried to make a move on her, and she told him no. And he continues trying to assault her, and she is yelling at this point, saying, "Stop it, no," all of it. But Tony claims he, quote, "doesn't know what came over him, doesn't know what kind of sickness," end quote.
There we go.
Yeah. And in his confession, he talks about what was going through his mind. He was thinking of his wife, his daughters, his home, his job, and how he couldn't lose everything if Laurie told people what happened.
That part. That's the one. See, that's not a sickness. It's fear of getting caught.
Right. So you can't remember things because of the sickness, but you can remember that, like, you have to kill her. Yeah.
It's bullshit.
Well, With that, he realized he can't let her out of this car alive. So he grabs a cotton cord, and in the interrogation room, he just keeps going back to how it, quote, got out of hand.
I believe it did.
Yeah.
Absolutely it did, but that's not how you respond.
Yeah, got out of hand is like his favorite go-to. So as poor Laurie is screaming, he's like punching her because he talks about how he was trying to knock her out. And this is when he unhooks her bra, which makes her scream even louder and more. So he's panicking at this point. And this entire situation is so disorganized and chaotic, which we know he hates because he likes to be in control.
Right.
So he wraps the cotton cord around Laurie's neck and the cord keeps breaking. But sadly, he manages to get the cord so tight that she was strangled to death. And then Tony claims he was completely distraught over it, and he even pulled over to throw up.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. This is the point that he dumps Laurie's body in the back of the restaurant, and Homer sees it. And he will also admit that he threw her school books and other belongings, like, in a random dumpster. So the detective is shocked. He had worked Laurie's case for more than 17 years, and he knew Tony was telling the truth, because Tony mentioned certain aspects of the crime that were never released to the media. And I do want to say that I feel like Detective Swaim and his team worked so hard to solve Laurie's case. Like, they interviewed almost everyone in Laurie's apartment complex. They retraced her route, like, at the same time in the morning that she would have been on her way to school. They, like, covered the area with posters asking for information. But towards the end of 1986... Swaim told the Houston Chronicle, quote, "Nothing is missing, and it doesn't appear that she was sexually assaulted. We don't have any leads or motive with this one. It's scary," end quote.
Wow, I can't even imagine what Swaim was feeling in that moment, because all of that work just to have some random dude then who was not tied to his investigation in any way just reveals himself almost 20 years later. Like, he had to be shook, you know?
Yeah, I feel absolutely.
That. Was Laurie's case ever tied to the other girls?
No, actually, that's a good question. Laurie was never tied to the other girls. And the reason for that, I don't know if you noticed, but I said he only used a cord to kill Laurie.
Right.
So he admits to the detective that he had injured his finger pretty badly when he was killing Laurie. Mm-hmm. So that's why he switched to a tourniquet. Because remember, he's a musician in a band, and he needs his fingers to strum the guitar. So Tony's next murder took place in 1992, which is kind of wild. Like, we don't often see a cooling off period that lasts 6 years.
Yeah, I don't believe him, but go on.
Yeah, I feel like that's a really long time to have not done anything.
Nothing that he's telling us.
Right. And in Tony's personal life, he's still married to Gina, although he's become more and more controlling. But as he explains to the detective, he had made a promise to himself that he would never kill anyone else. And he admits he continued to give women and girls rides to places, but that's it. At least until Thursday, April 16th, 1992. So we'll get to the second victim in a minute, but I want to touch base on Tony's home life. So we're in the early 90s now, and Tony and Gina's relationship is strained for several reasons. He doesn't do anything around the house. He's always playing with the band. And it should be noted, he was having affairs at this time. Like, he does admit to that. And at home, he's still being a complete shitbag to Amber because of her PDD diagnosis. But I guess he's better at tolerating her now, which is such a terrible thing to say about your child. But
it's probably because she's older.
Yeah, because she's a little older. That's what I think. But Gina talks in the book about how Tony just wanted to be the fun dad. He felt like spending money made him look successful. So he would buy the girls really nice stuff so they could show it off. And, like, to outsiders, it looked like this family's doing great, even though things weren't so great.
Yeah, it's all about image with these guys. Again, and that's, I think that's part of the power. Like, you know what I mean? You have this reputation to uphold.
Absolutely. And this was definitely a dysfunctional household. And unfortunately, the girls really suffered the most from this. His daughter, Tiffany, is on several TV shows, and she talks about how the girls were really isolated, and this led them to, like, not understanding basic social norms.
I believe that.
You know, that makes it hard to make friends, etc. And we'll come back to how this affected the girls, probably in part two.
Okay.
So that's kind of what's happening in Anthony's family life at that point. So I want to get back to victim number two. who was murdered on Thursday, April 16th, 1992.
Oh, my 12th birthday.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's about 10:30 a.m., and a man named Robert Levy was on the road making his daily deliveries to different restaurants around town. He was a delivery driver for Mrs. Baird's Bread, and he was en route to Dairy Queen on Westview Drive. So he gets there, he's backing his truck up towards the back door of the Dairy Queen, and when he looks in his side mirror to make sure he's parking straight, he sees something is in the way, and whatever it was like too big for him to just back over. So he gets out of the truck to move what he thinks is a big trash bag when he realizes it's a young woman. Like, just laying there in the drive-thru. And Robert is stunned, and he quickly runs to, like, the Dairy Queen's back door and is banging on the door and, like, yelling. And when the door finally opens, he tells the manager they have to call the police. So when the cops get to the scene, they are shocked. Because, first of all, they aren't sure who this young woman is. But they're just completely shocked from the violence that was inflicted on this girl. So our Jane Doe is laying on her stomach with her face directly on the asphalt. She had one arm kind of above her head and the other one tucked beneath her.
Okay.
And her legs had been crossed at the ankles. And the detectives are pretty certain our Jane Doe had been sexually assaulted. Her blouse had been pushed up to her mid-back. And they would later discover her bra had been sliced open in the front. Like, right down the middle. And then she was basically naked from her waist to her mid-thigh. Like, her underwear had been pulled down, and they were all caught up in her pantyhose, like, above the knee.
Yeah, 100% a sexual assault.
Exactly, yeah.
You don't even need the kit. I mean, you do need the kit for evidence purposes, but you don't.
Right. Well, the detective assigned to this case, a gentleman by the name of Sergeant Stuart Kennedy, he noted that the victim had a gold chain around her neck. So again, he's like, I don't think this is a robbery. Well, it was then that he noticed a thin white cord tied tightly around the victim's neck with several top knots. And at the back of her neck was a wooden dowel.
Oh, man, to turn. Oh, God.
Uh-huh. And unlike with Laurie's case, this victim didn't have any ID on her. And many sources differ on who gave the official identification, but ultimately, the victim was ID'd as 21-year-old Maria del Carmen Estrada, and she went by Carmen. So in 1991, Carmen, her father, her brother, and a few of her cousins, they emigrated from Mexico to the United States in search of, what else? The American dream. So the family lived all together in a very small apartment where Carmen was the only girl, so her male relatives were very, very protective of her. And it makes sense why, because not only were they in a foreign country, but A, Carmen didn't really speak much English, and B, Carmen was super teeny tiny, like just over 5 feet tall and just over 100 pounds.
Okay.
So although she was 21 years old, she looked so much younger. I think she was gorgeous. I think she kind of looked like Princess Jasmine from like Disney's Aladdin.
Oh, yeah, like the big almond eyes and like the thick dark hair. Like definitely, yeah. But definitely a petite woman. Like he had a type.
Yes. And he also, I don't know if I talk about this later, but he also has a type with long, dark hair.
Really?
Because he likes ponytails. He can get control.
Oh, yeah. I never thought of that.
Mm-hmm. Carmen was described as exceptionally shy, but incredibly kind once you got to know her and like she opened up. She was definitely a hardworking young woman, and she actually had two jobs. And this took up the majority of her time, obviously. But she always made time for church and prayer. She was a deeply religious young woman, and she was very adamant about abstaining from sex until marriage. Now, she did have a boyfriend. It was a young man named Jesus, and he was absolutely fine with this arrangement. I think he was pretty religious as well. Carmen and Jesus had started dating towards the end of 1991, and actually at the time of her death, they were starting to talk about marriage. So on the morning of April 16th, 1992, Carmen began her day super, super early, and she followed her normal routine.
Wow, which is not good.
No, we know how that goes. Yeah. So just like Lori, Carmen is up and out of the house before 7 a.m. It's dark out, and she would walk to the bus. She took the same bus, number 72, to the same stop every day. When she got off the bus, she would walk to her best friend Rosa's house, And the woman would have coffee together, and Carmen would assist Rosa in getting her kids ready, to go off to school.
Mm-hmm.
And then Rosa and Carmen would walk to the home of Janice Travis. So Rosa had been the nanny for Janice's son, but when she got a higher paying job offer, she recommended Carmen to take over the nanny role. So every morning, the woman would walk together, and Rosa would act as the translator between the mom and Carmen.
Hmm.
And then Carmen spent pretty much the whole day with the son. She finished around 4:30 p.m. and then she went straight to her next job, where she worked for a company who cleaned office buildings after hours.
Okay.
But unfortunately, that April morning, Carmen would not make it to Rosa's home. She wouldn't even make it to the bus stop. So we're going back to Tony's confession. And again, take it with a grain of salt. So Tony claims he began seeing Carmen in the morning on his way to work. He was still at Southwestern Bell. And he tells the detective that he would always stop and offer her a ride, but she always told him no. And she said, I don't really speak English, and I'm not getting in a car with a stranger.
But that was going to stop him?
Yeah, seriously. I mean, of course, he didn't take no for an answer.
Right.
Now, he claims, just like with Lori, it was one rainy morning when he asked Carmen if she wanted a ride, and she accepted. So she gets in the car and introduces herself as Carmen. And Tony goes on in his confession to say that he's been driving her every day for a few weeks, and they became friends. And he's so slimy, he's like, I had to brush up on my Spanish so I could flirt with her.
Gross.
So gross. And again, similar to Laurie, Tony is trying to make this a relationship. It's so weird. And as he confesses to Swaim, he goes, quote, once again, I felt it was going places. She was talking about, she wanted to go out, end quote. It just doesn't match up with what we know about Carmen. I find it very hard to believe, especially knowing that she's painfully shy and that she was in a serious relationship with Jesus. But
right.
Sure, Tony, whatever you say.
Yeah, not a chance, because he was obviously, how much convincing did it take to get her in the car to begin with?
Exactly. Well, one day they're driving and he tries to kiss Carmen, and he claims that she was okay with a kiss, but when he tried to take it further, he says she freaked out, and again, it got out of hand.
With good reason.
Right. Well, he locks the car door so she can't get out, and he claims that she began fighting with him. And again, the thoughts in his head are, if she tells anyone, your life is going to be ruined.
Mm-hmm.
So once again, he's not going to let her out of the car alive. Now, in this interrogation, Tony claims that he and Carmen did not have sex.
Well, he's a liar, so.
I don't believe him. So when her body was autopsied, she had the white nylon cord around her neck. It was only about an eighth of an inch thick. And at the back of her neck, the cord was knotted and tangled up in her hair. And in there, mixed in, was a little piece of wood about 3.5 inches in length.
Hmm.
So this is the first time he uses the tourniquet on a victim.
Wow.
And when the detective asks him why, he explains that he hurt his finger while killing Laurie. And he didn't want that to happen again.
Imagine the mindset it takes to leave a literal trail of bodies and then be concerned about your finger.
Right?
Unbelievable.
He's a maniac. So during the autopsy, the medical examiner noted that Carmen had what looked like a bite mark on her left breast, and there was, quote, blood in her vulva and vagina, as well as a contusion on the vagina in the 7 o'clock position, end quote.
Hmm.
So during this autopsy, that Sergeant Kennedy I mentioned at the beginning of this case, he was so adamant that her body be swabbed for any potential evidence. And he insisted that her fingernails got cut. Which is huge.
Yes.
And Carmen had fought hard, and Kennedy was hoping that she would have skin scrapings under her nails. And remember, this is early 90s, so DNA had only been discovered less than a decade ago. So major kudos to Sergeant Kennedy.
Yeah, it's not even on the radar. I mean, it's on the radar, but it's not being used yet, really.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, after Carmen's murder, the police, led by Sergeant Kennedy, they went hard trying to solve this case. This area is predominantly Hispanic, so they brought in a ton of bilingual officers to canvass neighborhoods and speak to anyone and everyone they could. So they also did what they did with Laurie, where they followed Carmen's normal route and talked to people who lived along the route to see if they had seen anything.
Mm-hmm.
And they even called the Houston Crime Stoppers to help out. But no matter what they did, it just didn't matter because within 6 months, the case had grown cold. And Carmen's case became known as the Dairy Queen Girl Murder. So now it's about 1993, and this is quite an eventful year. Tony tells Gina he's leaving her, and he wants a divorce. And I need to tell you how he told her.
I can't wait, because you can't text yet, because he would text if you could.
Yeah, he totally would. Well, it's Thursday, March 25th, 1993, and this is Tony and Gina's 10th wedding anniversary. So he takes her out to this nice dinner, then they go see a movie, they get home, and Tony surprises her with champagne, and he gets down on one knee, and he tells her he's been having an affair for months, and he's leaving.
Oh my God.
And then he did.
What?
Why?
I know. How? Like, yeah, he's just being a dick at this point.
He is a dick.
Wow.
So he leaves like immediately and moves in with his mistress, a woman named Elizabeth Martin, and she was the lead singer in his band. He would like call Gina to tell her how amazing the sex with Elizabeth was. And she's like, I don't care. So Tony moves in with Elizabeth and then he gets custody of Tiffany and Amber.
How did anyone give him custody? This girl that he talked so down to.
I know. I don't get it. And Gina is interviewed a lot in the book, and she claims that the girls began to rebel and they only wanted to live with their dad.
I don't get it.
Which is interesting because Tiffany is in several of the shows I watched, and she straight up says, neither one of my parents wanted to parent us.
Wow. And this whole time, it's funny, you don't think about Gina being this like bad mom the way you told the story. So then to hear this is kind of, I don't know.
Well,
maybe she was so messed up from all the mind games for all the years.
Yeah. And if you read the book, it's definitely not pro Gina, but it's not anything bad about her. And strange. Then in the TV shows that are more current, Tiffany's definitely like, no, she was awful.
Really? Well, you wonder if, so I have there's one of our listeners who I'm not going to name, but she's going through something similar with her ex, and like he will manipulate the children to think certain things.
Mm-hmm.
If you get what I'm getting at.
Oh, absolutely. So maybe that's I don't know what happened. Yeah, I don't know. I just felt so bad when Tiffany said that. Like, as a kid, to be like, neither one of my parents wanted us.
Yeah, he's probably talking smack to the kids about Gina putting these thoughts in their head.
Right. Well, they did end up with Tony, and Gina went ahead and moved in with her boyfriend. So, like, I'm torn on her. And there were some accusations about Gina being an alcoholic and how she couldn't raise the girls. But again, she denies this, so I don't know. And at first, the girls were excited to live with Tony because, again, he never disciplined them. You know, he was the fun dad, but that changed pretty damn quick.
Yeah, when you have full custody, it's not as easy to be here sporadically fun dad.
Yes. So all of this next information I'm going to tell you comes from Tiffany in one of the shows I watched. I think it was I Lived with a Serial Killer or something.
Mm-hmm.
And she's in at least two of the shows that I saw, and there's a few more she's in. So she talks about how the girls moved in, and it's basically a nightmare almost immediately. Tony would cook steaks for himself for dinner and then tell the girls to like figure out your own dinner.
Wow.
And he would say he was the man, he made the money, and he could buy whatever he wanted for dinner, and if they wanted their like to pick their dinner, they could get a job.
Cool guy.
This is so gross. He would make the girls eat peanut butter sandwiches, and Tiffany talks about this huge jar of peanut butter that he would make them eat out of, and it was like filled with ants.
Oh my God, really?
He talks about trying to eat cereal and finding cockroach eggs.
Ew.
So gross.
What? This reminds me of Michelle Knight, Lily Lee, the stuff that Ariel Castro was making her eat. These old pizza and just nasty food. Yeah, yes. Rotten food.
Tony wanted to save money, so he made the girls share bath water. They had to hand wash their clothes, and pretty soon they were like the smelly kids at school.
I'll bet.
Yeah, and Tony would go about his business, and he made the girls stay inside the house all day while he was gone. He boarded up the windows and deadbolted the door so they couldn't get out. Well, this is when Tony begins not only physically abusing the girls, but also sexually abusing them. He would drug them every night with Benadryl-laced hot chocolate and then assault them. And there were many times that the girls woke up and were forced to endure this abuse. And like this happened over several years, but I believe it started it started in 93. And we find out later that Tony's sister had called CPS quite a few times and nothing ever happened. Now, on that note, I'm skipping ahead a little bit, but in January of 95, the girls confided to the school nurse what was happening at home. So she immediately reported it, and a social worker came to the house to speak with the girls, but Tony found out about the visit beforehand. So he had the house looking perfect. He like made a roast, so it looks like this beautiful dinner. He put the girls in new clothes and told them that if they said anything about the abuse, they would be taken away, they would be separated, they would put in foster care, and they'd be abused even more.
Wow. My control. This is what he was doing with his family originally, like putting on the show.
Yes. Well, and Tiffany talks about how, like, we had these fancy, like, certain things, like electronics or whatever, but we didn't have the basic necessities.
Right.
Well, the social worker comes over and she sits with the girls and asks the validity of the abuse claims. And I don't know how this was set up, like, if Tony was within earshot, but it seems like he might have been because the girls lied and said, nope, everything's great. Which then CPS's hands were kind of tied.
Yeah, they go away.
And you know, these girls are going through hell. They're abused, neglected. They're getting teased at schools. They're getting drugged by their dad and taken advantage of and just living in absolute hell. And Tiffany eventually becomes suicidal.
I mean, I don't blame her.
Yeah. She tries to overdose on aspirin. So she did that and she lived. Well, Tony didn't give a damn. He told her, get over it.
Man, this is gross. He's a monster.
He's awful. We're almost done because I'm like sick of him. So we need a break. Well, our next victim survived her encounter with this monster, but what she went through is horrible. And he made sure to confess this one to the detective because he wanted him to know he could have killed the girl, but he didn't.
Oh, like, what an upstanding guy.
Like, oh, yeah. He says something to the detective like, I attacked her to prove to myself that I was capable of not killing. What?
I don't even have words for this guy anymore. Like, this is so disgusting and just, what does he think he's accomplishing with all this? He's gloating about all these crimes.
I don't know. Like, he's so gross. And the date of this attack is a little bit unclear because the victim lived, so like, we don't even have her real name, you know, so the date I found doesn't quite coincide with when Tony says it happened, but we know it was sometime 93, 94.
Okay.
And this girl was a minor at the time, so again, not too much detail, but essentially, Tony began stalking a 14-year-old. He spent time learning her routine, he followed her, like, home every day when she walked home, and in his confession, he talked about how he knew she was a latchkey kid. Like, he knew she got home to an empty house. So one day, he broke into the home and waited for her to get home from school. Oh, and while he waited, he stole $20 off her parents' dresser.
Oh, well, because why not at that point?
He's such a class act.
I'm sorry. This is all the stuff that we've talked about and like comparing him to Bundy and stuff. This is different because I feel like Bundy would choose random victims. This guy's like studying and following and learning routines. Yeah. It's this is scary. Creepy on a different level.
Yes. He says that when she got home from school, he overpowered her and he tied her hands behind her back with an electrical cord. And of course, he doesn't admit to raping her in his confession, but he definitely did. Like, he kind of bypasses it in every confession. When he's done, he tells her that if she goes to the cops, she better tell them that her attacker was a short, fat black man.
Wow.
Yeah. And then he says if she gives his actual description, he'll come back and kill her entire family.
And you have to take him seriously.
Right. How could you know? She's 14. Like, of course. Right.
Yeah.
Well, this poor girl is kicking and screaming, and yet again, in Tony's head, he's upset because it got out of hand. And the detective is like, did you try to kill her? Tony confesses that he did try to strangle her, but he stopped. He said, quote, I think I was going to use my hands, and I just freaked, because I promised myself I wasn't going to do this, and all of a sudden, like, the pathology and the anger and the freaking out, I kept telling myself, this isn't necessary. This is not. None of it is necessary. So I bolted and I left.
Dude, you're not trying to stop biting your fingernails. Right! Like, I don't understand. And I will never understand. We can listen to psychologists dissect these guys all day long. I think they're just straight miswired from birth.
I completely agree. Wow. Well, that's where we're going to end because I think we need a break. He's a lot.
I'm exhausted from thinking about the things that he was doing his own daughters. My God.
He's sick. And it's like he just gets worse and worse with everything he does.
Yeah. There's no shame whatsoever.
Mm-mm. Well, next week we have two more victims before he gets caught. And they're rough. So that's why I think we should just stop here because it's too much for one sitting.
Yeah, good thinking. Yeah, let's talk about Gil. That was a happy experience.
Yeah.
And I hope everybody enjoyed the way we cut that. It was a little tough because we had to try to appeal to the listening audience too. But like, I feel like Gil did an outstanding job of bringing it all together in the fact that when we were just on him, you heard little sketchy noises. It's like,
yes, I love that.
And then he would educate as he was talking. Like he was explaining what he was doing, which I think filled that what I thought was going to be dead space.
Yeah.
And I think it came together really neat. And hopefully people didn't care too much if I used the old ending that we recorded first because I had different clothes on. So like we're talking and then it just cuts to us in different clothes because I thought our other ending was better.
Yeah, because it was.
Yeah, I wanted to give thanks to all those people and we didn't in the follow-up when we did with Gil. So I just wanted to make sure that got included. So if we had an abrupt wardrobe change, you weren't seeing things.
Taylor Swift has like 20 wardrobe changes in her tour, so it's fine.
That's all we were doing. Yeah,
exactly.
Except we put on the same clothes we had on earlier.
Oh, I wish I was wearing sparkles.
She doesn't do that.
No.
She never picks up the sweatshirt next to her bed and puts it on.
The one on the floor covered in dog hair, because that's what I'm wearing right now.
Yeah, the one where you go, and then,
I lint brushed myself. Thank you very much.
Oh, that's good. I have this wrinkle release that I make. So you basically put 2 tablespoons of fabric softener in a jar. And then you fill the rest with warm water and you shake it. And that is what they charge $7-$8 for in the store. I could make it home for nothing.
I buy the one in the store.
Well, if you want me to make you some, it's that easy.
I made my own ones. And I feel like it didn't work. So I went back to the store brand.
It's not going to work on the things that you just pull up from God knows where. Like it can't be like, can't find it in your car and expect it to work. You got to spray it.
Well, they don't say that on the back of the bottle now, do they?
No, but basic wrinkles it will take out. I think that's...
You should try it on your forehead.
Oh, my God. Goodbye. Goodbye.
Wait, we're not finished.
Yeah, we are finished. You know where to find us on socials. Perverts don't wear signs. Goodbye.